Blog Talk Radio.
One of the more extraordinary people I think I've ever interviewed.
Helen Caldicott is talking about filmmaker Michael Madsen. His movie, Into Eternity, documents the building of Onkalo, the world's first storage for nuclear waste. Hear their conversation about civilization, language, danger, and eternity. On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In prisons in the Americas, there's deep concern that COVID-19 infections are spreading rapidly amid chronic overcrowding and unhygienic conditions, coupled with the lack of proper access to healthcare. The UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Tuesday, thousands of inmates and prison officials have already been infected across North and South America, triggering protests and riots. Here's OHCHR spokesperson Rupert Colville speaking via video conference.
On the 21st of March, 23 inmates died after security forces intervened to suppress rioting in La Modelo prison in Colombia. Other incidents, including attempts to escape, have been registered in detention centers and prisons in Argentina, Brazil, and Colombia, Mexico, and the US.
Mr. Colville urged authorities to conduct thorough, prompt, independent, and impartial investigations into how people had died during the riots. The gravity of the measures taken to quell the disturbances seemed to indicate that in some cases, states had not used appropriate measures, he said. In March, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet urged governments everywhere to protect people in detention as part of COVID-19 containment measures. To Afghanistan now, where UN agencies have reported an official warning that up to 80% of the country's people are at risk from the COVID-19 pandemic. UN Migration Agency IOM and the UN Refugee Agency UNHCR said that a randomized sample of 500 people in the capital, Kabul, had showed that half of the city's 5 to 7 million residents were likely infected. Social distancing is not practical in a country where the average family size is 7 and where most live in one-room homes with poor ventilation, IOM said. Worsening conflict in the past 3 months has also hampered health efforts, with lack of access to non-government controlled areas preventing testing in around a third of the country. In a related development, both agencies said that Afghanistan is struggling to absorb more than 270,000 labourers who've returned from neighbouring Iran and Pakistan since January. As of Tuesday, Afghanistan had recorded 2,900 confirmed cases of new coronavirus and 90 deaths. Asked about reports that Afghan workers had drowned after being forced into a river by Iranian border guards, UNHCR spokesperson Babar Baloch said it was a sad and worrying incident which the agency was monitoring. Finally, well over 40 million people across West Africa face desperate food shortages in coming months, twice as many as before the COVID-19 pandemic began, the World Food Programme, WFP, said on Tuesday. Appealing for support, WFP spokesperson Elizabeth Bierce warned that the new coronavirus risks weakening communities that have already fled armed conflict and endured climate change emergencies.
We must sustain our assistance to these people across the region, especially in places such as Central Sahel, Central African Republic, Nigeria, and Cameroon. An additional 20 million people could struggle to feed themselves due to the socioeconomic impact of COVID-19 in the next 6 months, doubling the number of food insecure to 43 million in this region.
An estimated 12 million children under 5 years old could be acutely malnourished in the lean season from June to August, up from 8.2 million in the same period last year. The development comes as the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, on Friday said that West and Central Africa had one of the largest displacement situations in Africa, with 5.6 million internally displaced people, more than 1.3 million refugees, and 1.6 million stateless people. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
We could be facing multiple famines of biblical proportions within a short few months.
That is David Beasley, Executive Director of the United Nations World Food Program, speaking at the UN Security Council on April 21, 2020. Normally, announcements from global officials are full of sugar and no content. Not this one. This former governor of South Carolina is warning about a horror compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic and even more deadly. I'm going to play you Beasley's 9-minute presentation because it's worth it. Then we'll hash through the new food crisis in America and around the world as disease and economic shutdown break down supply lines. Our guest is author and energy activist Richard Heinberg, a driving force at the Post Carbon Institute and resilience.org. Let's go to New York as David Beasley warns the world.
Thank you, Mr. President, and of course, thank you for the opportunity to brief the Security Council today on this very, very important issue. And forgive me for speaking bluntly, but I'd like to lay out for you very clearly what the world is facing at this very moment. At the same time, while we're dealing with COVID-19 pandemic, we're also on the brink of a hunger pandemic. In my conversations with world leaders over the past many months, before the coronavirus even became an issue, I was saying that 2020 would be facing the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II for a variety of reasons, such as the war in Syria, Yemen, the deepening crisis in places like South Sudan. And as John Eglin, I know, will no doubt set out about Burkina Faso in the Central Sahel region, the desert locust swarms in Africa, as the Director General Chu highlighted in his remarks, and more frequent natural disasters and changing weather patterns that we're experiencing. The economic crisis in Lebanon, which is impacting millions of Syrian refugees, DRC, Sudan, Ethiopia, and the list goes on. We're already facing a perfect storm. So today with COVID-19, I want to stress that we're not only facing a global health pandemic, but also a global humanitarian catastrophe. Millions of civilians living in conflict-scarred nations, including many women and children, face being pushed to the brink of starvation with the specter of famine, a very real and dangerous possibility. This might sound truly shocking, but let me give you just some numbers. 821 million people go to bed hungry every night all over the world, chronically hungry. And as Dr. Chu just pointed out, as the new global report on food crisis that's published today shows, there are a further 135 million people facing crisis levels of hunger or worse. That means 135 million people on Earth are marching toward the brink of starvation. But now the World Food Program analysis shows also, due to the coronavirus, that an additional 130 million people could be pushed to the brink of starvation by the end of 2020. That's a total of 265 million people. On any given day now, WFP, we offer a lifeline to about 100 million people, up from about 80 million just a few years ago. This includes about 30 million people who literally depend on us to stay alive. If we can't reach these people with the life-saving assistance they need, our analysis shows that 300,000 people could starve to death every single day over a three-month period. This does not even include the increase of starvation due to COVID. In a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about three dozen countries. And in fact, 10 of these countries, we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation. And in many places, this human suffering is a heavy price of conflict. At WFP, we are proud that the council made the historic decision to pass Resolution 2417 in May 2018. It was amazing to see the council come together. Now we have to live up to our pledge to protect the most vulnerable and act immediately to save lives around the world. But this is only, in my opinion, the first part of the strategy needed to protect conflict-riven countries from a hunger pandemic caused by the coronavirus. There is also a real danger that more people could potentially die from the economic impact of COVID-19 than from the virus itself. This is why I'm talking about a hunger pandemic. It is critical that we come together as one united global community to defeat this disease and protect the most vulnerable nations and communities from its potentially devastating effects. Lockdowns, economic recessions are expected to lead to a major loss of income among the working poor. Overseas remittances will also drop sharply. This will hurt countries like Haiti, Nepal, and Somalia, just to name a couple. The loss of tourism receipts will damage countries like Ethiopia, where it accounts for 47% of its total exports. The collapsing oil prices in lower-income countries like South Sudan will have an impact significantly, where oil accounts for 98.8% of total exports. And, of course, when donor countries' revenues are down, how much impact will this have on life-saving foreign aid? The economic and health impacts of COVID-19 are most worrisome for communities in countries across Africa as well as the Middle East, because the virus threatens further damage to the lives and the livelihoods of people already put at risk by conflict. WFP and our partners are going all out to help them. We'll do everything we possibly can. For example, we know that children are particularly vulnerable to hunger and malnutrition, so we are prioritizing assistance to them. Right now, as you may know, 1.6 billion children and young people are currently out of school around the world due to lockdown. Nearly 370 million children of these children are missing out on nutritious school meals. You can only imagine when children don't get the nutrition, which means their immunity systems are down. But this is why we are providing nutritious school meals where we possibly can in these suspended areas to help, whether it's take-home rations to help the families and help these children. As you know, WFP is a logistic backbone for the humanitarian world, and even more so now for the global effort to beat this pandemic. We have delivered millions upon millions of personal protective equipment, testing kits, face masks to about 78 countries on behalf of the World Health Organization. We are also running humanitarian air services to get frontline health professionals, doctors, nurses, and humanitarian staff into countries that need help, especially while the passenger airline industry is basically about shut down. But we need to do more than this, and I urge the Council to lead the way. First and foremost, we need peace. As the Secretary General recently said very clearly, a global ceasefire is essential right now. Second, we need all parties involved in the conflicts to give us swift and unimpeded humanitarian access to all vulnerable communities so that we can get the assistance to them that they need, regardless of who they are or where they are. We also need, in a very general sense, humanitarian goods and commercial trade to continue flowing across the borders, because they are the lifeline of global food systems as well as the global economy. Supply chains have to keep moving if we are going to overcome this pandemic and get food from where it is produced to where it is needed. It also means resisting the temptation to introduce like export bans or import subsidies, which can lead to price hikes and almost always backfire. WFP, we're already working hand in glove with governments to build and strengthen national safety nets. This is critical right now to ensure fair access to assistance and to help maintain peace and stability and prevent rising tensions among communities. Third, we need coordinated action to support life-saving humanitarian assistance. For example, we are implementing plans to pre-position 3 months' worth of food and cash to serve country operations identified as priorities. We're asking donors to accelerate the $1.9 billion in funding that has already been pledged so that we can build stockpiles and create the life-saving buffers and protect the most vulnerable from the effects of supply chain disruptions, commodity shortages, economic damage, and lockdowns. You understand exactly what I'm talking about. We're also requesting a further $350 million to set up a network of logistics hubs and transportation systems to keep the humanitarian supply chains moving around the world. They will also provide field hospitals and medical evacuations to the frontline humanitarians and health workers as needed and strategically. 2 years ago, the Security Council took a landmark step when it recognized and condemned the devastating human toll that conflict paid in poverty and hunger. Resolution 2417, it also highlighted the need for early warning systems. And today, I'm here to raise that alarm. There are no famines yet, but I must warn you that if we don't prepare and act now to secure access, avoid funding shortfalls, and disruptions to trade, we could be facing multiple famines of biblical proportions within a short few months. The actions that we take will determine our success or failure in building sustainable food systems as the basis of stable and peaceful societies. The truth is, we do not have time on our side, so let's act wisely and let's act fast.
That was the Executive Director of the World Food Program, David Beasley, speaking to the U.S. Security Council on April 21st, 2020. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Let's talk this through with our guest.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
How much should we worry about the world's food supply, especially during this pandemic? Scary stories are pouring in, but who can speak wisely about such a big picture, not just in America, but in global terms? Just as the United Nations warned of famine in 2020, possibly of biblical proportions, Richard Heinberg published his article, Fraying Food System May Be Our Next Crisis. Richard is a journalist, author of 13 books, a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, and a force behind resilience.org. Richard, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be speaking with you again.
As schools and business closed down suddenly with the arrival of a novel coronavirus, There was a rush of panic buying, as you know, at supermarkets in many countries, and the predictable shots of bare grocery shelves appeared on the net. But after that initial shock, most food reappeared, not all of it, but most, and authorities assured us there is plenty of food. Were you surprised by the way this went?
No, not at all. You know, we're in the early stages, actually, of the pandemic itself. And certainly in terms of its impact on the food system, I think we have many months ahead of us of uncertainty. And so initial rebounds in food allocation are certainly welcome. But at the same time, it's not an indication that somehow the problem is solved. There's a huge systemic issue in front of us.
Yes, you've been writing about the fragility of big agriculture and the food delivery system literally for years. What were the endemic problems even before the coronavirus struck last December?
Our modern food system is unsustainable in a number of ways. The primary way is just simply that our food system depends so much on fossil fuels. And of course, fossil fuels are finite and depleting, and burning them produces climate change. So anything that depends on fossil fuels is problematic to start with. But that's just the sort of background unsustainability of the food system. There are lots of other factors. The food system depends on ammonia-based fertilizers, which are produced from fossil fuels, and those fertilizers themselves are sources of pollution. They create dead zones around river deltas all over the world. Petrochemical pesticides and herbicides create air pollution and water pollution. Modern agriculture contributes to deforestation and loss of biodiversity. And then it depends on monocrops, like huge fields of genetically uniform corn and soybeans. Lots of other crops are grown this way. But when you do that, the crops are highly vulnerable to pests and diseases. If you're a pest, and there's zillions of genetically identical plants arrayed before you, then what a feast. And then the modern food system is characterized by long supply chains. This is not just the food system. It's really the whole modern economy. We've created long supply chains to take advantage of the cheapest raw materials and the cheapest labor wherever they exist on the planet. But long supply chains are brittle. That means that they can be broken at many points. And so, you know, if you're a consumer in Brussels or Beijing or Los Angeles, you may be dependent on a supply chain that stretches to the other side of the world for the food you're eating for breakfast. Also, the system tends to exploit low-wage workers wherever they are. Here in the United States, where we live, we depend on low-wage seasonal migrant workers, many of them from Mexico or Central America. And then food is often unequally distributed and even unhealthful because of the ways that we have organized the food system and because of the way that the food system is organized to be, you know, commercially profitable but not necessarily optimal in terms of consumers. So in North America, we have an epidemic of obesity that's related primarily just to the quality of food that people are eating. Very large amounts of sugar, highly processed foods, and so on. So it's a food system that really is like a series of ticking time bombs. And this is before the coronavirus. This is what we think of as normal. Our normal food system was already packed with problems waiting to happen. And the coronavirus pandemic has lit the fuses on those time bombs in many ways that are intersecting.
Well, you and I are going to talk about the grave international food situation shortly, but why don't we begin with the news that we know closer to home? In North America, meat processing plants have become super spreaders, with thousands of COVID-19 cases going out into the rural communities around them, and those communities are not prepared for that. Why there, and what does that mean for the food supply?
Well, in many of these rural communities, the local meatpacking plant is the big employer, and people work in very close quarters with one another, so they are ideal places for the spread of the coronavirus. When I wrote my article, which was published April 23rd, at that time only three meat plants had closed, and I've lost count of the number since then. It's been at least five. Tyson Foods, which is a big meat producer in the U.S., has the board chairman of Tyson has said, quote, "The food supply chain is breaking. Millions of animals are going to be depopulated over the next few weeks." In other words, killed meaninglessly, not for food, but just because there's no way to get them to market with so many slaughterhouses closed, meatpacking facilities closed. So this is a terrible crisis just for the meat industry and for people who depend on meat in this country. Store shelves are emptying out, and there's really no sign of a solution. President Trump has said he wants to use his powers to force meatpacking companies to remain open. But then you put yourself in the position of the workers there. The unions that represent them are fighting back and saying, look, you know, if it's not safe to work there, then our workers should not show up, regardless what the president says. So this could be setting up a labor crisis on top of an economic crisis, on top of a public health crisis. It's just one more example of sort of the intersectionality of crises, if you will, that the pandemic is provoking.
And the governor of Iowa has said that if the workers don't return, then she wants the companies to report those workers so that they can be slashed off the unemployment rolls. So essentially, it sounds like in many places or in some states, the same thing's happening in Texas. You will either go back to work or you will starve. And those are the options. And it almost sounds like they don't care how many die.
Yeah, you know, this is really bare-knuckle stuff, and a tremendous amount of human suffering is going to happen needlessly, simply because the people in charge really don't know how to act in this kind of crisis. Some governors are taking a very different approach. Gavin Newsom in California is in the process of creating something like a statewide CSA, community-supported agriculture, where he's organizing producers to create millions of boxes of food to distribute to the most marginal segments of the population on a weekly basis so that people are getting fresh produce that would otherwise rot in the fields for reasons I'm sure we'll talk about a little later in the program. It's not a complete lack of leadership, but I have to say, particularly in this country, in the United States, much of our difficulty is being exacerbated by poor leadership.
Here in British Columbia, about 1,000 farm migrants were met at the border and housed for 2 weeks by the government in quarantine. Four of them turned up positive for coronavirus, and the rest went on to farms near Vancouver or in the Okanagan Valley. What's the policy? What's happening with the agricultural migrants needed to get those crops from California to feed the nation there?
This is another problematic area. The Trump administration has designated food and agricultural workers as a, quote, essential group of workers who are advised to keep working even if their states announce, you know, shelter-in-place orders. But many of these essential workers are also working outside the law, technically speaking. They don't have papers. They're undocumented. And so they can be rounded up and deported at any moment. Also, the border between the U.S. and Mexico is now closed, making it difficult to impossible for documented seasonal migrant farm workers to cross. Farm workers are absolutely essential to the North American food system. So it's a real question how this is going to play out over the course of the rest of this year. Farm workers are also highly vulnerable to the coronavirus. Most of them have no PPE, personal protective equipment, other than maybe a bandana to protect their face. Many of the places where they're working have no hand washing facilities, and they typically have to travel from job to job, packed into vans and buses. Often they live in very crowded housing, so they're extremely vulnerable to getting sick. But even if they fall ill, they're likely to continue working just because they don't have any fallback. They don't have any place they can safely go to be treated and recover. This is one of the problems that's impacting not just the meat system, but also the rest of the agricultural system, and will do so increasingly as the year wears on.
You've raised a really important point, because we look at Singapore, which had their coronavirus pretty well under control. People were praising them. Cases were going way, way down. And then suddenly they've had an upspike and thousands of new cases, and it's coming from a migrant community where people lived all packed together in slums, and the authorities really hadn't paid a lot of attention to them. And then that flowed back into the rest of the Singapore community. So there's no islands here. There's no isolation where if we let these migrants get sick and keep on working, that it won't come back to the major cities of the United States.
Right. And the closing of the borders is highly controversial. Many people are saying that it's a political act on part of the Trump administration. Other public health officials are saying that it's something that's necessary in order to keep the virus from spreading. And that sort of mirrors the conundrum that we face overall with regard to dealing with this spreading sickness. Do you close down the economy, keep everyone home in order to keep the virus from spreading? Well, of course, if you do that, then it creates economic havoc. But then if you open up the economy and let people get back to work and go shopping and go to sporting events and so on, then you face the prospect of, you know, massive spread of the disease, increase in death, overwhelming of hospitals and so on. So there's really no good answer. And the same with what we're talking about here. We need the farm workers in order to make our food system work. And yet, by forcing them to work, we're actually creating another reservoir by which the virus can spread.
In the Okanagan fruit-growing valley near me, some farmers are spraying extra fertilizer on the tree buds. The point is to cause the flowers to fall off before fruiting, because the farmers can't find the migrant workers. They want to kill off this year's crop but save the trees. So I may have to take my fruit-picking ladder to local farms and pick my own fruit for canning to get through next winter. It all seems so strange, like we can't adapt to change, so we just have to kill off the food while others are lining up for the food banks.
Right. I know that the tragedy of seeing millions of gallons of milk being dumped, crops of beets and potatoes being plowed under while the food banks are straining because they have so much demand. Suddenly they have a huge increase in demand and not enough supply. It's the irony is terrible. It's one of the factors that's causing alarm at the highest level. You mentioned the UN World Food Program and their warning, David Beasley, who's the head of the World Food Program, warning of a hunger pandemic that will bring what he called the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. You know, when I started researching my article back in early April, I thought long and hard about whether even to follow through on writing it, because you know, talking about this subject, talking about the problem with the food system, is likely to cause readers to want to go out and buy and hoard more food. It's a natural human response, but that only makes the situation even worse. So I ultimately decided, you know, this is something that we all need to understand and know about. This is a crisis that's headed our way that may turn out to be actually worse in humanitarian terms than the the pandemic itself. The UN World Food Program is forecasting currently we may have as many as 300,000 people a day perishing over a three-month period from famine later this year. And that would be a much higher toll than the virus is currently taking. So this is a problem that we need to deal with on a societal basis and in terms of our communities and our households at the very highest priority.
Part of this food threat, Richard, comes from the return of nationalism in America, in South America, and even some European countries. If food exporting nations under stress close their borders to agricultural products, then famine will surely hit the less developed world. I noticed that Russia has already banned wheat exports. And when Russia did that in 2010, following their great heat event and fires, rising bread prices helped fuel the Arab Spring revolutions in the Middle East, as you know. Talk to us about food nationalism in this picture.
We are seeing this as a trend globally. China has been increasing its strategic food stockpiles, and that, of course, removes food from the market channels. Serbia has stopped shipping sunflower oil. Romania has banned grain exports. Kazakhstan, which is one of the world's top exporters of wheat flour, has suspended exports. Vietnam has stopped accepting new orders for rice. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, we have a highly networked global system of supply chains for food. That's both for raw materials and also for processed foods. For processed foods, the problem is even bigger because that means the supply chains are longer and have more possible breaking points. But just due to food nationalism, it's very likely that we could see shortages of particular foods, even in wealthy countries, even in places like Canada and the United States and Europe. Some of our preferred foods and processed foods and packaged foods may be absent from the shelves for a long time. But, of course, this has really dire implications for countries that depend on imports for staples, whether it's rice or maize or wheat. This, again, is just another facet of this exponentially metastasizing problem.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from California. Our guest is author Richard Heinberg. The real threat, as the UN makes clear, is in the developing world. I mean, in your article, you didn't predict that Americans would starve, but now we're seeing that many poor countries were already mired in the debt trap, and some had plunging oil prices, which removed all the income, whether it's in Iran or Saudi Arabia. Many oil-producing countries, well, Venezuela is just the classic case. And the result could be a famine of biblical proportions. But also, let's consider the reduced health and immunity once COVID-19 does get to those countries. The results could be tragic. In the 1960s, there were big famines. I vaguely recall. I was just a kid. But millions of people died, mostly in Asia. Those have not been seen since, but maybe they're coming back now in 2020 or 2021.
Right. And the part of the problem is, which we haven't really talked about yet, is the problem of food affordability. The pandemic is, as we all know, creating an economic crisis where millions of people have been thrown out of work. Their incomes, in many cases, have been lost or reduced. So if food prices increase while people's income declines, that, of course, is a recipe, if you will, for hunger and malnutrition. So Oxfam on April 9th said that 500 million people could be thrown into poverty around the world as a result of the pandemic. That I think that's probably a conservative estimate, but you know, half a billion—that's extraordinary. And if people have no money, they can't buy food, and so the only solution will be for governments to take charge of the food system in various ways and make sure that their populations are fed. You mentioned the Arab Spring, one of the causes of which was hunger. The Syrian civil war, same thing. Governments become untenable. The governments fall when people start going hungry. So, you know, world leaders had better step up. They better understand that, you know, it's not just their jobs and reputations that are at stake, but history's judgment as well.
For me, one of the sleepers in international news is India. Coronavirus is still in its hidden stage there, with numbers creeping up. There's hardly any testing. You've got 1 billion people living in close quarters. The government shut everything down officially, but you still see crowds of people on the streets, and there's, I believe it's around 500 million people. It's hundreds of millions of people are now out of work because they were sort of migrants from the rural villages who come for work in the cities, and now they're going back to their villages. And have you thought about India, and do you have concerns for that country?
Yeah, I do. I haven't made India a specific focus of my research on this, but thank you for suggesting that. As soon as we get off, I'm going to turn my attention to that country. But you know, it's the second most populous country in the world, and it's a country that faces not only the pandemic and the possibility of food shortage, but also something else we haven't talked about yet, which factors into this, and that's the impacts of climate change and the effect of climate change on weather and agriculture. That is something that we are seeing in North America. We've had bad weather here for the last couple of years in terms of too much rainfall in the American Midwest and South. And so far this year, 2020, is starting out with basically the same pattern. So once again, it's kind of an intersection of crises, and I think India is also poised for that. India's been very hard hit over the last few years with climate-related weather.
Well, Richard Heinberg, before we get back to the predictions of mass famine for this year and the food crisis that we have in our own countries, we have a parallel crash in the world oil and gas market. For over a decade, you were part of the peak oil movement, which predicted we would run out of those fossil fuels. But as we speak, there are super tankers full of oil with nowhere to land. Storage tanks are full. How did we get from running out of oil to a glut, which makes it almost worthless?
Right. Well, oil, of course, like all fossil fuels, is a non-renewable depleting resource. So we started running out with the very first barrel that we took out of the ground and burned. And the problem was always one of the low-hanging fruit syndrome. We harvest the highest quality, easiest and cheapest to access resources first, and leave the nasty, dirty, hard-to-get stuff for later. And increasingly, it's been getting later and later over the last number of years. During the last decade, new supplies came online, mostly from U.S. tight oil produced by hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling. And this was expensive to produce oil. In fact, the companies that specialized in fracking almost never turned a profit, very rarely. It was an atmosphere that was dominated by sort of investment mania. It really got started after the financial crisis of 2008 when the Federal Reserve injected trillions of dollars into the economy. Almost all of that money went to the investor class, which was looking for the next big thing. And the frackers were able to convince everyone that they were the next big thing, that they were able to produce very large amounts of oil very quickly, which they did. But as I said, they did so almost always at an actual financial loss. Now the proverbial chickens are coming home to roost, and oil prices have fallen because demand for oil has fallen so much, with so many people out of work and not flying from place to place. The airline industry is literally on life support. Passenger miles driven is way down all across the world. So demand for oil has plunged by, I've seen estimates up to 20%. And the oil-producing nations aren't able to slash their production enough or fast enough to support prices. And so we have a glut where on one day, I think it was last week, Monday last week, the price of West Texas Intermediate crude fell to minus $37 a barrel, the first time in history. The oil prices have gone into negative dollar territory. And what this really portends is that the death of the oil industry as we have known it, which from one standpoint is a good thing. You know, our dependence on fossil fuels is not a good thing, and it results in climate change, pollution of air and water, and so on. But on the other hand, we depend on these energy sources currently for everything we do. Fossil fuels are the economy. Everything, literally everything we do depends on a little fire somewhere burning fossil fuels, even to build solar panels and wind turbines, even to build a hydro plant that takes fossil fuels that entail some fire somewhere, putting CO2 up into the atmosphere. So until we change that, the death of the oil industry is one more factor that's going to upset our whole modern economic system. For over the short term, low oil prices could actually help consumers, the food industry, and other parts of the economy. But there's no longer a price for oil that works for both producers and consumers. And that means we're in a new era. It's something completely different from what we've experienced in decades past. It's the way we set up the economy for resource extraction, energy usage, and so on. It just is not working anymore. And how we're going to sort this out is going to be one of the big questions for the remainder of the century.
What is shocking me, though, is how slow the bankruptcies are coming. It's as though the whole business world is in suspended animation.
I know. Well, it's partly because the Federal Reserve has ridden to the rescue again with another couple of trillion dollars into the financial industry. That works out to about $17,000. If that were divided equally among American households, it would be like $17,000 per household. That's how much we're paying to keep the financial economy going.
But that's just fantasy money.
Oh yeah, and it will be revealed to be fantasy money at some point, but we're not there yet.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Richard Heinberg, and we're talking about the food crisis that may come out of the current corona pandemic. So, Richard, how do you see the troubles of the oil, gas, and coal companies tying into the greater economic meltdown that is happening, and even into the pandemic itself? Are there feedback mechanisms at work here?
Oh, absolutely. And there are feedbacks that go both ways. The economic crisis, as I was just saying a few minutes ago, have fed into the energy industry economic crisis. I mean, the vanishing profitability of the oil industry. But the oil industry is a big part of the economy in a couple of different ways. First, from a financial standpoint, I mean, if the oil industry, much of the oil industry goes bankrupt, that will hurt a lot of investors and put even more pressure on the financial economy. But also the product that the oil industry produces is the very basis of all economic activity. So There are feedbacks going every which way. And I think it's impossible at this point to see what all of those impacts are going to be. As I say, we're in completely new territory, and all bets are off in literal as well as figurative terms.
For Canadians and people in Europe and other parts of the world, it looks like American society is not set up to do well in a pandemic. I mean, unlike every other industrialized nation, America doesn't have a public health care system, really, and it's not dedicated to feeding its own people. Even in time of crisis, we haven't seen Trump put out any program to really help the people on the food bank lines or the 30 million unemployed. And there's a deep suspicion about government, millions of high-powered guns, you've got religiosity. Unless there's a miracle vaccine or a treatment, I wonder, can America survive its own internal weakness in this situation?
Yes, I think that's a very real question. On top of all of the other problems that we've been discussing, the intersecting crises around the coronavirus pandemic, we have on top of all of that in the United States a political crisis. And this, of course, has been festering for a long time before Donald Trump became president. Increasing political polarization, distrust of government. But now these trends have really reached a crisis point. During a national crisis like a pandemic, a successful response depends to a very great degree on trust. Citizens trusting one another and citizens trusting their government. Right now, we're seeing an evaporation of trust all across the board. It's hard to trust a government that's as incompetent as the Trump administration has shown itself to be. And nevertheless, the citizenry is so polarized that there's still something like 40% of the American people who refuse to see the Trump administration as anything other than, you know, the best and brightest and finest group of people who've ever occupied high position in the country. So the situation is one that will no doubt have historic implications. History has shown when nations reach these crisis points of war or pandemic or economic crisis like Great Depression, how they manage to come together and the quality of the leadership that's available has long-term implications. History sorts nations according to how they respond during crisis. And if the United States was, as some historians have said, a sort of empire in decline prior to the pandemic, I think the pandemic is accelerating that process to a very high degree. We've seen other countries respond to the pandemic much more successfully with trust among citizens and trust in government. South Korea is an example of that, Taiwan. Many nations actually in the East have done quite well in terms of fighting the virus and maintaining their cohesiveness as a society. If history is any guide to the future, then I think a shift of global power eastward is a very likely result of what we're seeing today.
I noticed just in the last couple of days, as the Italians come out of their long lockdown with tens of thousands of deaths, there has been among some a wave of anger. There is a search for what they call justice, maybe lawsuits, maybe a reaction against the political class, and a search for someone to blame. Now imagine all that in America after a bruising 6 or maybe even 8 months or more of repeated failed attempts to control this virus, where we open up and shut down and open up and shut down. Waves of anger could follow this, and I wonder what that would look like.
Political violence, I think, was a very real possibility in the United States even before the pandemic, political violence erupting around the 2020 presidential election. That seems even more likely under current circumstances. And with so many other things to worry about, it's tragic to have to contemplate that in addition. But it's hard to avoid, you know, seeing that as a very strong likelihood.
But we're at a pivot point, and the heart of your work, Richard Heinberg, has not just been to illuminate weakness and threats to our system. You champion solutions, and you help create institutions to drive those changes, like the Post-Carbon Institute. What are some of the things that our listeners in developed countries could do to help alleviate food stress?
First of all, the natural human response to food stress, economic crisis, and food stress is to start growing more of your own food. Obviously, not everyone can do that. People who live in apartment buildings, in very highly dense urban areas, don't have that option. But for anyone who can, this is an excellent opportunity to begin growing more of your own food, something that we've been advocating for many years. And lots of people are doing that. We're seeing runs on plant starts, vegetable seeds all across America. Master Gardener gardening classes are seeing floods of applicants wanting to learn more about gardening. If you're able to take a permaculture class online and learn about permaculture principles and practices, that would be a really valuable use of time during the pandemic, and there's lots of information on YouTube about permaculture. But in addition to growing more of your own food, it's really important to maintain communication and trust with your neighbors. During times of crisis, neighbors help each other out, and they are typically the first source of help during not just the kinds of crises we've been talking about so far, but wildfires, earthquakes, extreme weather events, and so on. So having a sense of neighborhood and community resilience is extremely important in times of crisis. So that means talking to your neighbors and sharing plant starts and seeds with them, finding out who's growing what, offering to share in the produce, finding out who in your neighborhood might be in a particularly vulnerable situation in terms of need for food. Make sure that everyone is taken care of, and you'll be taken care of too. It's as simple as that. There are guidelines available for community leaders in terms of food security. The Pan-American Health Organization, which is a division of the World Health Organization, has a PDF online called Food Security in a Pandemic that can be downloaded for free. If you are or know someone who is a community official, that's a very, very useful resource. Also, if you are or know someone who is a community or government leader, it would be a good idea to begin having discussions about food rationing and the various forms that food rationing can take. Rationing is very successful at staving off shortages during times of economic crisis, as we have seen during World War I, World War II, and other times through history. In the United States, we have a continuing food rationing program called the Supplementary Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, sometimes known as food stamps. And that's something that needs to be broadened and brought into every community. It already is in just about every community in the U.S., but it needs to be supplemented with local food rationing programs. These are some things to start thinking about and getting involved with, and they have side benefits. All of these things have side benefits. You know, gardening means getting outside, getting exercise, getting fresh air. Talking to your neighbors means having something much more interesting to do than just watching television. These are solutions that are within everyone's grasp and really should be being promoted by community leaders.
I understand that commercial real estate is starting to crater because corporations can see people can work from home. A lot of people can, not everyone, but a lot. And those big costly offices downtown may not be worth it. Maybe the commute will be a lot lighter. Do you see society making fundamental changes in the post-virus world, Richard?
Oh, yes. We are in a new historical moment. We will never go back to the way we organized ourselves economically and socially prior to 2020. It's much too early to make detailed forecasts of how all of this is going to come out. There's a great deal that we don't know, even about the virus itself, how transmissible it is, the degree of immunity and the length of immunity that persists after a person has recovered from the sickness. There's a lot that we don't know that will have tremendous implications for how societies recover and reorganize themselves. But many fundamental aspects of our society have been broken already by the pandemic, including parts of our financial system and our energy system and our food system. They're going to require years of work to reorganize and reimagine and rethink. Hopefully, we will spend those years rebuilding those systems in ways that are more sustainable and equitable. This is a historic opportunity to address a lot of problems that have been festering in society for a long time that we have refused to deal with on a broad basis, including economic inequality, climate change, and others. Now, either we address those problems, or we will end up with a system that is even more centralized and even more brittle than it was before. If we go down that path, then there is a whole set of further crises, probably much worse than the one we're facing now, that will hit one by one and all together. So this is a historic opportunity to build societal resilience from top to bottom and to address the inequities and the unsustainability that we've lived with for way too long.
I think we can make some good changes, but it is stunning. Several new developments each day floor me, and I wonder how to move forward. It seems like last Christmas was another world that is not coming back. How is it for you? How are you coping with all this?
Well, staying busy and trying to get outside, taking walks in the neighborhood. And my wife is a master gardener and loves to be out in the soil. We have four chickens who lay eggs for us, and they're wonderful characters to share our lives with. So I actually feel quite privileged, and I think it's good to have hobbies in situations like this. Mine is playing the violin, and I've been spending a couple hours a day, you know, revisiting Mendelssohn Violin Concerto and some other pieces that I hadn't looked at in years, and that's a good way to stay sane. So the arts, whatever your hobby, you know, this is a good chance to indulge it. But don't waste the time that you have just watching TV or fretting or worrying. This is a time to think deeply and broadly and with courage about, you know, what life could be in the next months and years.
Well, we fear the worst of people could come out in this perfect storm, but we are seeing the best of people, especially in those brave frontline workers. I know it sounds trite, but I can't believe the bravery of the people who go to work in hospitals and who hand out those food bank packages in the long lines, and all the people who manage to keep this thing going despite their own fear for their families. So it's possible that all that could gather together into something good.
Yes, there's a lot of good that can come out of what we're going through right now. And I completely agree with you that the courageous people who are out on the front lines, my wife's, a couple of her cousins are nurses in New Orleans. One of them has already had COVID-19 and recovered, and she's back at work. I just have boundless admiration for healthcare workers and people growing our food and people working in grocery stores and all of these other essential jobs, industries. really are heroes and heroines, and they, most of them, don't get paid nearly as much as they deserve for the sacrifices that they're making.
Well, as we wrap up here, Richard, will you continue your world watching and writing?
Yes. If folks want to keep up with what I'm doing, there are a couple of places they can go on the web. One is resilience.org, which is my organization's website, Post Carbon Institute. It's updated every day with new articles about building resilience. And so that's very good. And if they're interested particularly in my own writing, they can go to richardheinberg.com.
Yes, you have your famous Muse letter. Is that still going?
Oh, yes. I think we're up to issue number 326 or something like that. And it's been a monthly publication since January 1992.
Wow. I thought I was early when I picked it up in 2006, but you've been going a long time. Thank you so much for being there, Richard, and for joining us today on Radio EcoShock.
It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Alex. You take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
With every program during this pandemic, there is too much stunning change to process and too little stunning change to avoid things getting worse. I guess you and I will just have to take it week by week and hope we stick around to see how things turn out. Will the reckless get punished by illness and death? Or will social dissension kill those who try to save them? Will we rebuild the death economy, make a new sustainable world? Or too little of both? Can democracy survive? How about NFL football or trance concerts? It's a cliffhanger. Would you want to just once travel forward in time 5 years to see how this turns out? We do know some things. Radar images from space confirm extra-large volumes of ice are melting off Antarctica and Greenland. It is pouring into the sea. And new hot zones are popping up in the ocean. Record land temperatures are expected this year. With climate change, we mostly know what damage is coming, although we're not sure about exactly when. We do not know what other troubles humanity may face this decade, from the new depression to possible wars, famine, and more diseases. But whatever those challenges may be, they will happen under a hot new sun, strong weather, and a rising tide. We must rise to meet it. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. From the archives, Helen Caldicott and Michael Madsen, Into Eternity. This is a conversation between Helen Caldicott and Michael Madsen, whose film, Into Eternity, premiered in the U.S. in February 2011. It is a rebroadcast of Helen's weekly radio program, If You Love This Planet. Helen called Madsen one of the more extraordinary people I've ever interviewed. And I know that if you heard the initial broadcast, you will look forward to hearing it again. In the whole discussion about nuclear power and nuclear waste, the meeting of these two people, Helen Caldicott, who dedicated her life to alerting us to the nuclear danger, and the young Danish artist's completely new approach to the topic in his film, Into Eternity, make for a thought-provoking exchange. Into Eternity is a documentary on the building of the world's first permanent repository for nuclear waste in Finland. It shows not only the construction underway that will take 140 years, but shows the people involved, the scientists, regulators, and corporate executives who oversee this project. None of them will be alive when Onkalo, as the repository is called, will be finished in 2120. And they must expect this repository to remain intact and untouched by future humans for 100,000 years. Such is the danger and longevity of waste from nuclear power plants. Mattson says that Onkalo may become the most important expression of our civilization. He is intrigued by the fact that as humans have mastered the power of the universe, their discovery has outstripped human ability to understand the consequences. Even though our use of nuclear power will affect life for at least 100,000 years, we are not even capable of resolving the question of how to warn future generations of the danger of the material that we are leaving them. And is it not madness to believe that anything built by humans could ever last 100,000 years? The film and this conversation is so intriguing because these questions are the subtext to a philosophical exploration. Here's Helen Caldicott introducing Michael Mattson and the film.
My very special guest today is Michael Mattson, director of the new documentary film Into Eternity. Into Eternity is a film about the vast amounts of radioactive waste created every day by nuclear power plants the world over and the constant challenge to find an adequate way to store it. A review of the film in The Guardian said, "Jaw-dropping, tackles a subject almost beyond comprehension. One of the most extraordinary, factual films to be shown this year." Mattson's film does not merely ask tough questions about the implications of nuclear energy, but about how we, as a race, conceive our own future. Michael Mattson is a film director and conceptual artist who has been guest lecturer at the Royal Danish Academy of Art, the Danish Film School, and the Danish School of Design. He is the director of several documentaries, including the award-winning To Damascus, a film on interpretation produced in 2005. Michael Mattson joins us now on the phone from Denmark. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Michael.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to ask you first, how did you conceive to do a film about nuclear waste? What was it that initiated your interest in the whole thing?
Essentially, it was the 100,000-year aspect that somebody in Finland is building a facility that has to last in a foolproof manner for 100,000 years. That was what caught my attention, because I thought that, first of all, these persons, these experts, they will have to be able to relate to understand what 100,000 years is, which I think is very, very difficult. And secondly, they will have to have some kind of scenarios for the future, some ideas about how the future will look like in this time span. And that is what got me really, really interested. And then I thought that this has to be the first time in the history of mankind that we are building something like this, and also something which is not in any kind of religious context, as would be the case with the cathedrals of the Middle Ages or the pyramids. So my basic question has been, throughout making this film, what does such a facility tell us about our own time? What is its true significance? Perhaps it's something beyond being a storage place for nuclear waste. These are the things that I was trying to look into.
What do you mean by that last statement? Perhaps it's something beyond being a storage facility for nuclear waste. What do you mean by that, Mark?
Well, I had this kind of suspicion that this is not just digging a hole in the ground and essentially building a kind of a bunker-like structure. And I think that the aspect of the facility where this shows most clearly is that this facility is built in a way so that it is able to operate without any human interference once it is completed about 120 years from now, it'll be sealed off and then it'll enter and kind of a silent mode operation. And the reason why this facility has to be independent of human surveillance and power supply, which is of course the case with any such interim facility in the world today, where the waste is, these pools that will cooling the waste, etc. The reason for this silent mode element is that in this time span, the scientist simply does not expect civilization as we know today to last. That means that the knowledge about what nuclear energy is and therefore what radiation is will simply vanish at one point. And therefore, it is not considered possible that any kind of, you can say that it has to be independent of what we humans know in the future, because otherwise it would be too dangerous. It's more safe if it can operate by itself. And that is because this facility, the Junkalo facility in Finland, is the first, possibly, as one critic said or wrote, possibly the first post-human structure on Earth. In its very construction, it has the notion that civilization as we know today will not last for this time span.
Or maybe humanity.
Well, I can tell you that some of the scientists that I've been working with for this film, they, in a way, have expressed less concern in terms of the danger, at least towards humans, because, yes, it is conceivable that mankind will not last for this long. And I can also tell you that in the Swedish legislation concerning nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste, the talk is about creatures, living creatures, and not just humans.
Interesting. Well, yeah. There are several questions I have then, Michael. I've always thought that the waste, and I think the EPA in America, Environmental Protection Agency, or some such agency, says it should be isolated from the environment actually for 500,000 years, not 100,000 years.
It's 1,000,000 years in the US.
1,000,000. Well, therefore, yes. Why are you using the figure of 100,000 when it is 1,000,000 in the US?
Yes, that's a very, very good question. I'm using the figure of 100,000 years in into eternity because that is what the law in Finland states.
Oh, it's the law in
Finland.
So
in Finland, this is the quarantine time, so to say. And I can't tell you why it's only 100,000 years in Finland and 1,000,000 years in the US. I think that the only thing that these two figures really tell us is that the experts do not agree about how long is this actually dangerous. One independent nuclear waste scientist whom I consulted in making the film so that I would have somebody to sort of verify what I was being told by the participating experts in the film, and also just to make sure that I got the points, she told me that it should be at least 250,000 years.
Mm.
But one of the problems and one of the unknowns in making such a facility is that we don't have any experience with nuclear waste in such concentrations as will be the case in such a repository. What happens inside the waste is unknown because nuclear waste does not only contain plutonium and uranium. In the process, inside a reactor in a nuclear power plant, almost every known element in the universe is created. And that means that the exact composition of the waste is not entirely known. And what will happen inside the reactions that goes on in the waste is not fully clear.
Yes, there was a fair bit of work done on that by scientists relating to Yucca Mountain, where the U.S. decided to store its 64,000 tons of civilian radioactive waste in a volcanic mountain made of actually pumice, which is just ash from the volcano. And they talked about the fact that after 100 years, things are going to be very hot. I mean, we've got the zirconium fuel cladding, which probably will go along with the radioactive waste, and that reacts with water, and that causes hydrogen. And they also said it could get terribly hot, and that it, by 100 years, would have corroded through any containment that it was put in, And also, it shouldn't get wet, but they also found that the pumice mountain at Yucca Mountain let water through. Therefore, they were going to put, after 100 years, titanium baffles over the top of the containment vessels. But, I mean, who would decide to do that? And we'll all be dead. And will our second generation or our great-grandchildren or great-grandchildren know to do that or want to do that? Or
yes.
Yeah.
Well, that is the basic problem. Can we... First of all, is it fair towards the future generations to impose a burden on them in terms of maintenance? Secondly, is it at all possible? Because that will require that knowledge about what it actually is can be carried on. And this is, of course, this question about should we warn / inform the future or not for 100,000 years? That is what inter-eternity is really sort of circling around. And the problem is, of course, that you can also put the argument forward that, in fact, it's better not to inform the future. That is, at least, actually the preferred strategy in Finland, simply to hide it. And Onkalo, which is the name of the facility, means hiding place. And the idea is that what we are actually fighting here is not a technological problem. We can make a kind of bunker. That's possible, we think. But an even bigger problem is human curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we may have some kind of stone tablets with information, it is still not clear if this will be understood 50,000 years from now.
Well, sure, because, you know, when you think back 2,000 years ago, which we now think is antiquity, that's when Jesus lived, they didn't even speak English. English hadn't been developed.
No,
that's only 2,000 years ago.
Yes, yes, that is true. Regarding language, what we know for certain, the only thing is that it changes over time.
Yeah.
And that is why we would have problems in understanding a person from the Middle Ages, etc. But if the real problem is human curiosity, somebody would like to open such a place if they found some kind of indication that something is buried here.
Mm.
And you're not able to detect what it is because all knowledge about radiation is gone and you cannot smell it, feel it, or sense it in any way, then you have the real problem, because then you may have somebody who inadvertently opens it and brings out some of the material.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of the village in Brazil where a hospital sent a capsule of cesium-137 to the rubbish dump because they didn't need it anymore, and a family found it, and they found that it glowed blue in the dark, and they used to paint it on their faces, and they ate it, and they put it under their beds and watched it at night. Well, that whole family died, but the whole village was contaminated simply because people had no idea what they were dealing with.
Exactly. And the problem is, of course, also that this may happen, and then somebody gets an idea that this is actually dangerous, and then it can be used as what we today would call a kind of dirty bomb. And there's also a source of military power in a waste in a waste repository like this.
You know, I think the Americans choose a million years because when you think about it, plutonium has a half-life of 24,400 years. Some people multiply that by 10 to get the total radiological life, but some multiply it by 20, which brings you up to half a million years. And then you see radioactive iodine-129 has a half-life of 17 million years. And there are quite a few isotopes that have extremely long half-lives. So I suppose to encompass the whole gradient of radioactive elements, and as you said, almost every element is made in a reactor, they put the number at a million. But it would be interesting, wouldn't it, Michael, to research why the Americans have chosen a million years.
Yes, but you know, when I asked the scientists in Finland, I received in a way two kinds of answers within the same company. The communication manager said, Michael, you have to understand that nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste, becomes less and less toxic because of the half-life. So really, Michael, it's all the time diminishing the problem from day to day. And then long-term safety expert, or the head of the long-term safety, he said, "Michael, I do not agree with this way of talking about high-level nuclear waste, because essentially, when we're talking about these time spans, it is forever.
Mm-hmm.
In a human time scale, it's forever."
Yes.
So, and I think that is very, very true. To talk about 100,000 years or a million years doesn't really make sense. But what we have to think about is that it is about 100,000 years that Homo sapiens left Africa for the first time. That is what we're talking 100, about.
100,000 years. I'm interviewing Michael Madsen, who made this incredible film called Into Eternity, and it's about the Onkalo project in Finland. Then we could move on. I know that the Department of Energy in America have been employing anthropologists to work out what sort of signs to put on their radioactive waste dumps. Are we a skull and crossbones, or a, you know, the scream, or what?
Yes.
What to put? Would you like to talk about that a bit?
Yes, because this is also what is discussed in Into Eternity, as I refer to these reports, which are just about the only ones in existence in the world. And
what, the anthropological reports?
Yes, and these discussions about what could we, what kind of marker could we envision. And the only thing that there has been some kind of consensus about is the scream, to be some kind of universal symbol that would be able to be understood by any society, any culture, at any point in time. The problem is, of course, that, well, it's impossible to test if this is possible, but also you will still need the marker to survive for 100,000 years or a million years in the U.S.
That's right.
And you will also need this marker to stay at the same point.
Yeah.
I can tell you that there is an interesting case in the U.S. I think it is the first nuclear test blast. A concrete slab was placed there, I think about a cubic meter or something like that, which then with a plague on. But it's also a cow field, so the cows have been scratching their backs against this concrete slab for 40 years. And now I think it's moved something like 10 meters from this scratching.
And you wouldn't want any earthquakes either, or that sort of thing.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And essentially, there are three strategies in terms of communicating towards the future.
Mm.
One is this kind of a marker with a universal symbol on it. The second one is to have a kind of archive system, which is really what the Finnish state opts for and which is discussed in the film. But then that, of course, depends on that one generation actually will pass on the information to the next generation.
Well, what do you
that
mean
there is a kind of institution.
What do you mean an archive system? I don't understand
well,
that.
Well, the Finnish idea is simply to have a kind of a library, a manned library. A manned library for 100,000 years. People
by
who constantly upgrade the information.
Oh, that's a good idea. How absolutely pathetically, it's like a fairy tale. I mean, God almighty.
Yes. Yes, but I have to say that in the film there is the main responsible for this idea. He hesitates a little bit towards where he actually thinks this will take place.
He does.
But the last idea which has been discussed is that if we could create a kind of a myth that would then by itself be retold because of the strength in the narrative from generation to generation, then this would be another way of perhaps passing down information. And Into Eternity, in a way, tries to perform such a task in the way of that it is narratively constructed. But these are the three strategies, and they all have problems.
Well, really,
we're
talking about Jesus Christ parables that have lasted and passed on generation to generation for 2,000 years. Now, the other thing, talking to you, Michael, I'm interviewing Michael Madsen, who made this absolutely wonderful film called Into Eternity, which it's very slow-moving, very thought-provoking, and people's jaws just drop when they watch it. They hadn't entertained this sort of philosophical approach to what we're actually doing at the moment. But, you know, as we talk, Michael,
and of course we have to understand that today all the waste in the world is sitting next to every single power plant in these pools where it needs to be cooled for 40 years at least. And if we imagine that these facilities will need to be turned into some kind of permanent solution, then there will be these repositories all over the world. And so it is not only certain parts of the earth that may have a problem if they leak these facilities. Mm. It may be many different zones.
Yes, it will become ubiquitous. When I first wrote my book, Nuclear Madness, back in 1978, I said you can imagine generations hence waking up in the morning, the food already radioactive, the breast milk
yes.
already radioactive, the children being born deformed or with genetic disease, developing their cancers
yeah.
at the age of six because they're exposed to radiation. That's the legacy that we leave to future
yeah.
generations. And although the Finns are trying to do something about putting this waste deep in the earth, I can't
mm-hmm.
see with the spread of nuclear power all over the world at the moment, I can't see people doing what the Finns have done. Can you, Michael?
Well, I'm trying to sort of pass on those questions through my film to any
mm.
individual in the audience.
Yeah.
But I think that it is clear that something needs to be done because the nuclear waste does exist. And even though you may be against the use of nuclear power, this will not in itself make the nuclear waste go away.
No.
So something needs to be done with the waste we already have.
Yeah.
And as we have seen at the Fukushima power plant, also the used, the spent nuclear fuel, the nuclear waste sitting next to the reactors has made troubles because, of course, the cooling of this waste also went away along with the reactor cooling. And this is the situation all over the world. This can happen at any site in the world with a nuclear power plant. And as is discussed in Intraternity also, the problem of world wars or wars, new states being formed, all of this instability above ground is a real threat to such facilities. And therefore, I could also get the idea that having it buried may be a better solution than having it above ground. Some of the scientists in the film, they told me that they find it very difficult to think that every nation in the world will be able to have such a facility as they are building due to financial restraints in the third world, so-called third world. But also in a country like Japan, they said they can never build a repository because of the geological conditions. But of course now, in my opinion, I fear that that this is de facto what they have now in the Fukushima, because it'll never be possible to dismantle this wreck of a nuclear power plant.
They simply
have to cover it up like in Chernobyl.
Chernobyl. Yeah,
yes.
But it's still hot, and Unit 1 is still fissioning. Still.
But that's why if they can get sort of total control, they can only cover it up. But what I think is important to understand in all of this discussion is that 100,000 years is perhaps beyond human comprehension.
Mm.
It is perhaps such a vast time span that we simply cannot relate to it. We may have a similar problem, for example, in Japan. One reason why the authorities, as I understand it, constantly have not been telling the full scope of the events, one reason behind that could be that it is more or less unthinkable that evacuate more than 30 kilometers, perhaps the whole of Tokyo area, etc. These things are sort of bordering on what is not only physically possible, but also to really understand how bad this is can also be difficult to understand because it's simply sort of outside of human comprehension. And of course, we humans, which is probably a good thing, tend to hope for the best. But in these matters, and as I always say about this film, that you know, nuclear energy stands on the shoulders of almost all the science, all the scientific knowledge that we have about the universe. It is really the powers of the universe that we are harvesting. So much knowledge is sort of fused together in this technology. And in that sense, it's the hallmark of human civilization. But the flip side is the waste, which has this time span built into it, which I believe is beyond what we can really understand. So on the one hand, it's based on deep understanding in a scientific respect, but it also has this very, very difficult time span for us even to relate to. And then if we cannot relate to it, if we cannot understand it or grasp it, it's suddenly impossible to act responsibly.
I'm interviewing Michael Madsen, who made this incredible film, Into Eternity, and it's about the Onkalo project in Finland.
Onkalo is the world's first permanent storage for waste from nuclear power plants. Blasted into bedrock in Finland on the island of Olkiluoto, on the shores of the Baltic Sea, it has to remain secure for at least 100,000 years. Many thanks to Helen Caldicott for permission to rebroadcast this intriguing conversation between her and Michael Madsen. The Canadian writer Naomi Klein said about Helen Caldicott, "She has the rare ability to combine science with passion, logic with love, and urgency with humor." Helen Caldicott has devoted the last 40 years to an international campaign to educate the public about the medical hazards of the nuclear age. This program was recorded by Helen's radio project, If You Love This Planet. Come back when TUC Radio returns for the conclusion of this conversation. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.